Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix. Looking down at the roadway of a suspension bridge to the tower and land beyond. Moving on the bridge, the vertical bars blur in passing. The bridge's cables and towers seen from below. In a moving car, a cable car crests a hill. A bearded man in a hat and sunglasses walks on a crowded sidewalk. Long-haired young people sit on the sidewalk. A tall bearded man kisses a woman. Two pairs of feet. One pair wears flip-flops.
I went to San Francisco because I had not been able to work in some months. Had been paralyzed by the conviction that writing was an irrelevant act.
A rat scampers down a leg.
That the world as I had understood it no longer existed.
A man carries a bedroll on his shoulders, a black and white photo of a woman with chin-length straight hair and a scarf around her neck.
It was the first time I had dealt directly and flatly with the evidence of atomization, the proof that things fall apart.
Words, slouching, Bethlehem, Hollywood.
If I was to work again at all, it would be necessary for me to come to terms with disorder.
Joan Didion, The Center Will Not Hold.
When snakes would appear so much in your later work, was that an unconscious image, do you think, from growing up?
I think it was an unconscious image from growing up, yeah. But I mean, snakes appeared in my later work because they were always on my mind. You had to avoid them. Do you have snakes? Do you have snakes?
I have no snakes. I'm not a big fan of snakes.
Well, how do you know up in the country?
I just take a rake and kill them.
Killing a snake is the same as having a snake.
Oh, yes, that's true.
A bookshelf, Beatrix Potter books, a notebook.
My first notebook was a big 5 tablet given to me by my mother with the sensible suggestion that I stop whining and learn to amuse myself by writing down my thoughts. The first entry is an account of a woman who believes herself to be freezing to death in the Arctic night, only to find when day breaks that she has stumbled onto the Sahara Desert where she will die of the heat before lunch.
Vintage silent film, a woman with 2 small children.
I have no idea what turn of a 5-year-old's mind could have prompted so insistently ironic and exotic a story. But it does reveal a predilection for the extreme which has dogged me into adult life.
The little girl has her brown hair in braids.
My Aunt Joan grew up on stories of the doomed Donner Party. Her family actually traveled across the plains with them. But they parted company when the Donners insisted on taking an uncharted shortcut.
Vintage photos of the party and the terrain.
Instead, her family followed the map that they brought, which safely guided them to the last frontier, California.
The state capitol dome.
I was born in Sacramento and lived in California most of my life.
Vintage film of girls playing croquet. Older Joan turns a page.
I learned to swim in the Sacramento and the American rivers before the dams. I learned to drive on the levees up and down river from Sacramento. Yet California has remained in some way impenetrable to me, a wearying enigma, as it has to many of us who are from there.
A street with candy cane decorations, a lake, a train winds through a valley.
My family had come to Sacramento in the 19th century. And they came to it as a frontier. And it was the last frontier. Don't you think sometimes people are formed by the landscape they grow up in? It formed everything I ever think or ever do or am.
Older Joan turns a page in Vogue magazine.
I remember that once when we were snowbound, my mother gave me several old copies of Vogue and pointed out in one of them an announcement of the competition Vogue then had for college seniors, the Prix de Paris. First prize, a job in Paris or New York. You could win that, my mother said. When the time comes, you could win that and live in Paris or New York, wherever you wanted. But definitely, you could win it. My senior year at Berkeley, I did win it.
Students on a college campus.
I got out of Berkeley, and I was offered a job at Vogue. So I moved to New York to take the job. It was very thrilling to me, naturally.
The high-rise buildings of New York.
When I first saw New York, I was 20. And it was summertime, and the warm air smelled of mildew, and some instinct, programmed by all the movies I'd ever seen, and all the songs I'd ever heard sung, and all the stories I'd read about New York, informed me that it would never be quite the same again. In fact, it never was.
Models on a street, a rack of clothes. Anna Wintour, editor-in-chief, Vogue.
When she was here, you know, some time ago, was it a moment in Vogue's history when if you were an editor, you would still wear a hat and gloves, and if you were just an assistant, no gloves, no hat. I mean, it was just a very, and everyone was addressed by Miss or Mrs. I mean, it was a very different time.
Phyllis Riffield, colleague at Vogue.
It would be exciting because Vogue was the preeminent fashion magazine. You had to learn to write with irony or with a kind of humor, you know, something that would grab the reader. You had to do it in this short space. You didn't have the luxury of writing and writing and writing. They would have been a little daunted by some of the editors. Eileen Talmy, whom Joan obviously knew, she could be very frightening.
On C-SPAN 2.
I can remember she would have this big aquamarine ring. She'd get violently crossing, X-ing out things, muttering, action verbs, action verbs.
A magazine article.
And everybody who lasted with her basically learned to write.
The first thing I wrote for Vogue was Self-Respect, Its Source, Its Power. They had assigned a piece called Self-Respect, Its Source, Its Power, and they had put it on the cover, and the writer didn't materialize. No piece came in, so I had to write it.
The Vogue cover. Photos.
People with self-respect exhibit a certain toughness, a kind of moral nerve.
Edna St. Vincent Millay.
They display what was once called character.
Willa Cather.
A quality which, although approved in abstract, sometimes loses ground to other, more instantly negotiable virtues. Character, the willingness to accept responsibility for one's own life, is the source from which self-respect springs.
Georgia O'Keeffe.
However long we postpone it, we eventually lie down alone in that notoriously uncomfortable bed, the one we make ourselves.
Via cable car.
Whether or not we sleep in it depends, of course, on whether or not we respect ourselves.
Younger Joan with a hat and gloved hands.
It seems like that would have been unusual for Vogue to have a voice like that, that personal. Was it?
Well, it was probably sort of unusual, yeah. I mean, you might have pieces on ways of doing makeup or something like that, but these weren't like that. They were personal pieces.
I started writing a novel basically when I came to New York. That was sort of what you did. You finally had gotten out of school, and now you were going to write a novel. So I'd work all day at Vogue, then I'd come home and have dinner or whatever and do this.
An edited typed page.
I didn't have any real clear picture of how to do it, so I would just do parts of it. Then I would just pin up these parts on the walls of my apartment.
A book on a shelf.
I think 10 people read it. I think a total of 11 copies were sold.
Jim Didion.
First time I saw her in print was probably her first novel, which was Run River.
Joan's brother.
It's not her best novel, but it was her first, and it was the story about people we knew. It was a Sacramento story, so I've always enjoyed that.
A photo, a man in uniform, a woman, and two children.
Here was the story about my father. There was about him a sadness so pervasive that it colored even those many moments when he seemed to be having a good time. He could be in the middle of a party at our own house, sitting at the piano, a bourbon highball always within reach. And the tension he transmitted would seem so great that I would have to leave, run to my room, and close the door. My father was severely depressed. But I didn't realize that at the time. I thought this depressed behavior was totally normal.
Children in a movie theater. Some cover their ears. One girl covers her eyes.
We went to the movies 3 or 4 afternoons a week. And it was there that I first saw John Wayne. Heard him tell the girl in a picture that he would build her a house at the bend in the river where the cottonwoods grow. Deep in that part of my heart where the artificial rain forever falls, that is still the line I wait to hear. As it happened, I did not grow up to be the kind of woman who is the heroine in a Western. And although the men I have known have had many virtues and have taken me to live in many places I have come to love, they have never been John Wayne, and they have never taken me to that bend in the river where the cottonwoods grow.
The Searchers. Framed in the doorway, John Wayne turns and walks away.
He's, you know, a protector. And you married a protector.
Mm-hmm. I did. Although, also a hothead.
Quick with a gun.
Yeah.
A photo of a brown-haired man with a cigarette in his mouth. Calvin Trillin, writer.
I met John Gregory Dunn at Time Magazine. We were just sitting in this building, often late at night with a lot too much to drink. And so there were a lot of affairs going on, but people were very quiet about it. John was a great gossip and always came into my office and held up his hand and said, "This you will not believe."
Trillin's novel.
I made him a character in a novel I wrote about working at a news magazine.
Floater.
The beginning of the book had a claimer instead of a disclaimer. And it said, "The character of Andy Wolferman is based on John Gregory Dunn, though it tends to flatter." Later he said, "Calvin, I was wondering, why was I Jewish in the book?" And I said, "That's the tends to flatter, John. You don't want to be a lace curtain Irish all your life."
On TV.
As Irish Catholics become assimilated, they lose something. They lose their Irish, which makes them unique. It's sort of a very sort of dark sense of humor that they have. The Irish sense of humor is said to be a man kisses the Blarney Stone and falls and fractures his skull, and that is what makes the Irish laugh. And I think there is that sense of storytelling. The Irish are great storytellers.
The Statue of Liberty seen from a ship.
As Joan's family crossed the frontier, John's grandfather came through Ellis Island at the age of 11 with only a third grade education. It was his love of storytelling that John always said influenced him to become a writer. He would offer the kids a quarter each, a lot of money at the time, to recite a Shakespeare sonnet or a poem. John went on to write 13 books, both fiction and nonfiction. His older brother and my father, Dominic Dunn, also became a journalist and novelist.
A portrait of the three men and Joan.
I went to Hartford and fell in love with his family and determined that I was going to marry him. And did.
A wedding.
I don't know what fall in love means. It's not part of my world. But I do remember having a very clear sense that I wanted this to continue. I liked being a couple. I liked having somebody there. I could not have been with somebody who wasn't a writer, only because that person would not have had any patience with me.
Standing next to John, Joan wears sunglasses in New York.
In the spring after we got married, Joan and I got fearfully drunk at this party. And the next morning, we had breakfast on Madison Avenue in a coffee shop, a drugstore. And John started to cry at breakfast. And so I had to go to work. And I got into work. I called her. I said, "Do you mind if I quit?" And she said, no. And I said, we'll figure out what we're going to do. And I went in and gave my notice. End of story. End of time.
A train.
It's easy to see the beginnings of things and harder to see the ends.
A flock of pigeons fly, the World's Fair Unisphere in Queens.
I can remember now with a clarity that makes the nerves in the back of my neck constrict when New York began for me. But I cannot lay my finger upon the moment it ended.
Snow collects on a streetlight.
All I know is that it was very bad when I was 28. Everything that was said to me, I seemed to have heard before, and I could no longer listen. I hurt people I cared about and insulted those I did not. I cried until I was not even aware when I was crying. Cried in elevators and in taxis and in Chinese laundries. That was the year, my 28th, when I began to understand the lesson in that story, which was that it is distinctly possible to stay too long at the fair.
Moving on a bridge away from New York. Fade to black. At the beach.
Then we decided to move to California for 6 months. I put an ad in the Los Angeles Times. Writer, wife, desire a house, you know. And the writer and wife specifically desired a house on the west side of Los Angeles, and we wanted to pay something like $300 for it. I mean, the whole thing was ridiculous. We finally got a house. Your mother went out and looked at it for us. It was that house in Portuguese Bend.
Written on a woman's knee, May 31st, 1965. She smiles and waves.
Only your mother would drive 60 miles to look at a house for somebody.
A woman and little girl walk hand in hand toward the water. John reclines in a lounge chair with the Sunday paper. Two dogs and two boys play in the water.
We love going to Portuguese Bend. Their house was on a bluff overlooking the Pacific. Joan would point out migrating whales, and John would take my sister Dominique, brother Alex, and I down to these tide pools where we'd catch sand crabs.
Dark-haired Dominic by a tide pool.
There was this cave, and we would swim, but you had to get into the water at a certain point and get beyond the surf.
A view of a rocky island and the waves on one side and an inlet on the other.
The tide had to be just right. We had to be in the water at the very moment the tide changed. We had to be in the water at the very moment the tide was right.
At her desk.
Each time we did it, I was afraid of missing the swell, hanging back, timing it wrong. He never was. You had to feel the swell change. You had to go with the change. He told me that.
With Griffin, she holds a photo of John and her.
Do you remember? Do you remember meeting me for the first time?
Maybe it was in Portuguese Bend.
Here's my, like, 5-year-old memory of meeting you. We were in the pool. Alex and I had matching swim trunks. These tight, like, bicycle pants with gold buckles on it. And we were, you know, this is during our leisure time and our matching bathing suits. And everybody was very excited about you and John coming over. Mom was kind of nervous and was telling us about, you know, we're going to meet John's wife. I'm meeting you, and John says, Griffin, you got a little something poking out of there. And I look down, and one ball has come out of the seam that was broken in the tight bathing suit. And Dad and John, and I think my mom, roared with laughter. And I was scarlet. I was so embarrassed. And you were the only one that didn't laugh. You were like, you just kept right on going, just like with a totally straight face. I always loved you for that. but John, of course, was relentless.
Griffin sorts through photos. On the bookshelf, John's book, Delano, The Story of the California Grape Strike.
6 months at Portuguese Bend became a year. John was writing a book about Cesar Chavez and the California Grape Strike, and Joan traveled along through the Central Valley to help with research and reporting.
Planted fields, people picketing, magazines on a table.
To pay the bills, they wrote countless magazine articles for the Saturday Evening Post, Holiday, Life, and Esquire.
Points West.
At one point, they even shared a column.
By Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn.
And despite how different their styles and points of view were, they would never turn in a piece without running it by the other for a final edit. They were each other's most trusted reader.
The children and dogs in the water.
Were you thinking about children at that point?
I was thinking about children. He was thinking about children, but we couldn't have one. Suddenly we got offered one.
What do you mean?
I mean, the phone rang one day.
Joan holds an infant.
I was taking a shower and burst into tears when John came into the bathroom to report what the obstetrician who delivered her said. I have a beautiful baby girl at St. John's, is what he had said. I need to know if you want her. An hour later, we stood outside the window of the nursery at St. John's looking at an infant with fierce dark hair and rosebud features. The beads on her wrists spelled not her name, but N-I for no information.
Well, I mean, there was no question that this baby was going to be ours.
Older Joan sorts through baby pictures.
Almost everybody I know who has ever had a child is afraid before the baby comes that they won't be up to it. The reality couldn't have been more perfect. I remember leaving the hospital with her and driving. We were on the San Diego freeway going home. I always thought of myself as bonding with her on the San Diego.
John, Joan, and the older baby.
These pictures are from Quintana's christening, taken 2 months after John and Joan brought her home. John might have been a lapsed Catholic, but he was Catholic to his core. The idea that something could happen to Quintana during those 2 months, sending her to limbo, was a risk John just wasn't willing to take. So, on their first night home, John, unordained John, waited until Joan was asleep, and he snuck Quintana into the bathroom and baptized her right there under the sink.
We had to move out of the house at the beach because they didn't want a baby. We were not writer-wife. We were writer-wife-baby.
A large two-story house. In the years I'm talking about, I was living in a large house in a part of Hollywood that had once been expensive and was now described by one of my acquaintances as a senseless, killing neighborhood. A busy street in Hollywood. A bar. A strip club. Since the inclination to rent an unfurnished 28-room house for a month or two is a distinctly special one, the neighborhood was peopled mainly by rock and roll bands, therapy groups, and by my husband, my daughter, and me. Susanna Moore, writer.
They had this wonderful old Hollywood house on Franklin Avenue. Big, not too much furniture, and I lived there for a while with them. I was trying to remember why I lived with them. She would come down fairly late in the morning. I'd be in the kitchen. She'd have a cold Coke in the bottle from the refrigerator. She'd be wearing sunglasses, silent.
I had to have Coca-Colas in the refrigerator. And they had to be really cold. And if anyone took my last Coca-Cola, we would have a scene in the kitchen.
There was always a big case of canned salted almonds, which her mother sent her, I think, for Christmas each year. It had to be more often because she ate them so quickly. And she would open a can. I remember the sound, you know that sound. I'd sit there with my coffee, and she'd sit there in her sunglasses with the Coke and the nuts, but neither of us speaking.
A photo of Jim Morrison.
So I like to sit around and watch people do what they do. I don't like to ask questions. Jim Morrison, I did a piece on. Rock and roll people are in many ways the ideal subject for me because they will just lead their lives in front of you.
Did you like the Doors?
I was crazy about the Doors, yes.
What was it about the Doors that drew you?
Bad Boys.
Street Signs, Haight Ashbury. Young people on the street. A slender young woman in a short toga dances.
I was doing a piece in the Haight Ashbury in 1967. And it seemed to me that we were seeing the tip of something important that wasn't about quote-unquote hippies, you know, that it was about disaffected children, etc.
A baby crawls on a stage. A woman wears goggles.
5 to 1, baby. 1 in 5. No one here.
David Hare, playwright, director.
The idea that you could actually write the history of your time, which I think is what Joan has done, through the essay, and that this could be a form which would be as supple and as versatile and as nuanced as fiction, is something quite extraordinary. She makes it do things that nobody ever made it do before.
Armed police at a protest.
The center was not holding. It was a country of bankruptcy notices and public auction announcements and commonplace reports of casual killings and misplaced children and abandoned homes and vandals who misspelled even the four-letter words they scrawled.
A wall of graffiti.
It was a country in which families routinely disappeared, trailing bad checks and repossession papers. Adolescents drifted from city to torn city, sloughing off both the past and the future, as snakes shed their skins. Children who were never taught and would never now learn the games that had held society together.
Two young men pass a joint.
Children were missing. Parents were missing. Those left behind filed desultory missing persons reports, then moved on themselves.
A wall of photographs. Joan with 2-year-old Quintana.
I had a 2-year-old at the time I was working on that, so it was particularly vivid to me to see these other children. It was particularly vivid to me because I was away from the 2-year-old and feeling slightly cut off from her, yeah.
When I finally find my contact, he says, "I got something at my place that will blow your mind." And when we get there, I see a child on the living room floor licking her lips in concentration. The only thing off about her is that she's wearing white lipstick. 5 years old, the contact says, on acid.
What was it like to be a journalist in the room when you saw the little kid on acid?
Well, it was...
Joan gestures with both hands.
Let me tell you, it was gold. I mean, that's the long and the short of it is, you live for moments like that if you're doing a piece, good or bad.
A photo of younger David.
Obviously, we being repressed, miserable, dank English folk, we loved the sound of hippiedom, you know. We thought San Francisco sounded absolutely great to us. And so, you know, Joan did it in reporting from the heart of Haight Ashbury about what it was actually like, came as a bit of a bracing shock to us. That's not how we thought that the whole thing should be seen. But I can see that very early on, you know, in that early reporting, there's a sort of horror of disorder, which is very much a feature of Joan's writing. And Joan's personality.
Joan with an open book.
I was living in Los Angeles, and the magazines I was writing for were in New York, and so I was reporting on a lot of stuff that they weren't seeing.
C-SPAN 2.
Sometimes you would hit a piece that seemed that it could take a longer length than a magazine could give you, and I think I might do a nonfiction book someday, but I didn't do one for a long time.
The Bookshelf. Joan Didion, Slouching Toward Bethlehem.
It comes from that Yeats poem, When What Rough Beast Slouches Toward Bethlehem to Be Born.
A review.
It was reviewed by someone in the New York Times. He said what made this book so special is that it emphasized what used to be called character. And it was boom. And all of a sudden you were a figure.
More reviews. One titled Essays of Social Criticism. Another, Reporter, Essayist Speaks Out. Joan Didion, Portrait of a Professional. A photo, Joan in sunglasses.
Half moon, nighttime sky, seven stars, heaven's eye.
Someone once brought Janis Joplin to a party at the house on Franklin Avenue. She had just done a concert, and she wanted a brandy and Benedictine and a water tumbler. Music people never wanted ordinary drinks. They wanted sake, or champagne cocktails, or tequila neat. Spending time with music people was confusing.
Joan with a glass.
That party was maybe the biggest party we ever had.
Black and white film of the party.
Brings us out to call the old man.
About midway through the party, we realized that people were missing their cars. And I pointed this out to the parking guy. He said, what can I do, Mrs. Dunn? How did I know you lived in such a terrible neighborhood?
Still photos of the party.
The horrible thing I remember is going up to Quintana's room just to check and make sure that everything was okay. And there were drugs on the floor. I couldn't believe that anybody would do that.
A headline, rock singer Janis Joplin.
There were a lot of drugs around town at that time, and the presence of these drugs became all that was on anybody's mind.
27, found dead.
You wanted to get rid of them. You wanted to get them out of your house.
Spray painted on a door. Pig. On TV.
Friday night in Los Angeles, a movie actress and four of her friends were murdered. The circumstances were lurid.
Bel Air, California.
This was at the home of movie director Roman Polanski, and it was his wife, Sharon Tate, who was one of the victims. She, too, had been stabbed, repeated stab wounds. One of the victims had a hood placed over his head, and the word pig was written in blood on the door.
Many people I know in Los Angeles believe that the 60s ended abruptly on August 9th, 1969. Ended at the exact moment when the word of the murders of Cielo Drive traveled like brush fire through the community.
Where were you when you heard about Manson?
I was in your mother's swimming pool. Your mother was wearing a Pucci bathing suit, and the phone was ringing, and she answered the phone, and it was Natalie.
Natalie what?
And Natalie was calling to tell her that this terrible thing had happened the night before. Before the Manson case, everything seemed explicable. And suddenly, the Manson case happened and nothing was making sense.
News footage of Manson and his followers.
Tiny Linda Kasabian, 20 years old and 7 months pregnant with her second child, already has pleaded not guilty in the murders of actress Sharon Tate and six other persons.
Linda Kasabian, the person I was interviewing on the Manson case, told me they'd gone by at our house, which was spooky.
What was it like interviewing Linda Kasabian?
Well, I spent quite a bit of time with her, actually, both when she was in jail and before she testified.
A headline, Linda Kasabian to testify for state.
That was a weird
in Tate murders
situation, finding myself cooking dinner for Linda Kasabian and her child, and the child had to be bathed, and you know, the whole thing was weirdly. It was weirdly normal. And yet it was not normal in any way at all.
In this light, all narrative was sentimental. In this light, all connections were equally meaningful and equally senseless. Try these. On the morning of John Kennedy's death in 1963, I was buying at Ransohoff's in San Francisco a short silk dress in which to be married. A few years later, this dress of mine was ruined when at a dinner party in Bel Air, Roman Polanski accidentally spilled a glass of red wine on it. On July 27, 1970, I went to the Magnin High Shop in Beverly Hills and picked out, at Linda Kasabian's request, the dress in which she began her testimony about the murders at Sharon Tate Polanski's house on Cielo Drive. I believe this to be an authentically senseless chain of correspondences, but in the jingle-jangle morning of that summer, it made as much sense as anything else did.
A flowchart of words, Dealey Plaza, Manson, Dress, I. Magnin, The Bookshelf, Joan Didion, The White Album.
The White Album, I think those pieces are about the late 60s, early 70s. The Beatles album figured in the Manson trial. It was a kind of dark album, and that was the period.
Helter Skelter, written on a refrigerator. Hilton Owls, writer.
On the Beatles album, the White Album.
And critic.
There's ballads and there's sound experiments by Lennon. There are soft songs, hard songs, instrumental. She does a very similar thing in that essay, which I find profound. And also it took 10 years. If you look at the date, I think it's a 10-year period where she worked on it.
Joan in a Chevy Stingray.
You couldn't make a cohesive narrative about the times because the times weren't cohesive. So she found this way, which was to kind of make a verbal record of the times.
I am talking here about a time when I began to doubt the premises of all the stories I had ever told myself.
Film of an American flag burning. An honor guard folds a flag at a military funeral.
A common condition, but one I found troubling. I suppose this period began around 1966 and continued until 1971. During those 5 years, I appeared, on the face of it, a competent enough member of some community or another. I wrote a couple of times a month for one magazine or another, published 2 books, participated in the paranoia of the time.
The weirdness of America somehow got into this person's bones and came out on the other side of a typewriter.
Joan and John.
What was going on in your marriage?
Well, he was not happy with what he was doing. And what was going on in our marriage was we were not happy.
He had a temper, a horrible temper. Yeah. I didn't.
What kind of things had set him off?
Everything that set him off.
I want you to know as you read me precisely who I am and where I am and what is on my mind.
Joan at a manual typewriter.
I want you to understand exactly what you're getting. You're getting a woman who for some time now has felt radically separated from most of the ideas that seem to interest other people. You're getting a woman who somewhere along the line misplaced whatever slight faith she had in the social contract and the whole grand pattern of human endeavor.
The ocean. The sun on the horizon.
I had better tell you where I am and why. I'm sitting in a high-ceilinged room in the Royal Hawaiian Hotel in Honolulu, watching the long translucent curtains billow in the trade wind and trying to put my life back together. My husband is here and our daughter, age 3.
The text appears.
We are here on this island in the middle of the Pacific, in lieu of filing for divorce.
Did he read that?
He edited that.
He edited. So how does that, what was it, was it, we what went, was your agreement about just writing about your inner public life?
It was, we didn't have an agreement. We didn't have it. We didn't see it as a deal, you know, or a deal breaker. We thought generally that you wrote what, you used your material. You wrote what you had. And that was what I happened to have at the moment, at that moment.
Las Vegas.
You met in an apartment in Vegas. It was like a nightmare apartment. He never stayed in it. He never spent one night in it. He would go over there, and he would stay at a hotel.
A book, Vegas.
It was not a good time. Actually, it was a wonderful book, it turned out.
A Memoir of a Dark Season, John Gregory Dunn. A review. Vegas, A Writer's Trip into Despair. Another, Where and How the Chips Fall.
So you and Joan were both writing pretty dark stuff then?
Well, it was a dark time.
A book cover with a coiled snake, Play It As It Lays, Joan Didion.
She's in there, in the world, and she's writing about all sorts of ugly things. Look at Play It As It Lays, for goodness sake. Yes, the style is a very refined style, but the subject matter is not at all. And so there's this odd contrast between subject matter and style.
Mariah drove the freeway. She dressed every morning with a greater sense of purpose than she had felt in some time, for it was essential that she be on the freeway by 10 o'clock. Not somewhere on Hollywood Boulevard, not on her way to the freeway, but actually on the freeway. If she was not, she lost the day's rhythm, its precariously imposed momentum.
Mariah is detached in the way that a reporter is detached. Play It As It Lays is about what Mariah sees and what she feels, which is trying not to feel.
Mariah was quite a bit of myself, but obviously not line for line.
Joan with a cigarette leaning on the stingray.
What Mariah is going through in that book, she's coming to terms with the meaninglessness of experience. And that's what everybody who lives in Los Angeles essentially has to come to terms with, because none of it seems to mean anything.
Once we moved to the beach, I felt particularly good.
On TV.
Joan Didion lives hard by the sea, about an hour's drive north of Los Angeles. She shares life along the coast of her native California with husband John Gregory Dunn, who is also a writer.
The two walk along the wet sand.
The day would start with John getting up, building a fire, and making breakfast for Quintana and taking her to school. Then I would get up, have a Coca-Cola, and start work.
Joan by a typewriter. John at his desk.
Everybody had their own thing.
Slender Joan with a cigarette framed by tall, narrow windows. Joan in the kitchen. A handwritten recipe. Quintana on the kitchen counter. The three at the dinner table. The three barefoot at the beach.
How important is it to live here?
I like to look at the horizon. That is nice. It is always there flat. I like the way it feels here.
Tom Brokaw.
I got back to New York from the interview and wrote to her right away. And I simply sent it to Joan Didion somewhere on Malibu Beach. And that was the address that I had, that I couldn't, because I didn't have anything with me. And she got it.
Harrison Ford, actor, carpenter.
I was a carpenter to do a renovation expansion of their home in Malibu overlooking the ocean. And I spent a couple of months there. In their house every day, first thing in the morning, last thing, the end of every day. It's explaining why we hadn't made more progress and how it was going to cost even more money. There was a room that was developed, and there were bookshelves. There were decks and a wall of doors and windows. I had a young family. I think I became their carpenter for the same reason I became their friend, is that I was out of my depth, kind of didn't know where I was going, how I got there. Joan always had an Easter party. My family and I were always invited. And I always felt that everyone there was smarter than I was and more cultured than I was. But I was always made to feel welcome and comfortable.
Amy Robinson, film producer.
It was not the way you think of Malibu. It was very out there. It was far away, and it was shacks, and it was small houses, and it was people living very separately, and it was very Joan. Everybody and their brother showed up at this house. Brian De Palma, Steven Spielberg, Marty Scorsese, Warren Beatty.
Warren Beatty had a tremendous crush on Joan. She was well aware of it, as was John, and John used to be very amused by it. And if I had a dinner party, Warren would say to me, please, please, will you put me next to Joan, please.
It was a very hot atmosphere. I don't mean hot like sex hot. I mean hot like creative hot. And everybody was talking about movies, and everybody was arguing about movies. John, being the great raconteur that he was gathering material, and Joan was gathering material, and they actually were interested in what we thought, and they were interested in the ideas that we had. Fade in, interior subway day. The camera holds very tight on her face as she hangs from a strap in the crowded subway. She looks ill, drawn, scarcely able to cling to the strap.
The Panic in Needle Park, directed by Jerry Schatzberg. The young woman rotates around a metal pole. An article, The World of Needle Park, by James Mills.
I had read this book by James Mills. It was developed from some pieces he'd done in life. It just immediately said movie to me. I had John read it and Nick. Each of the three of us put in $1,000.
You had to go to the producer and describe the movie in one sentence. And their sentence for Panic in Needle Park was, it's Romeo and Juliet, but they're junkies.
A woman drives a Corvette. Play It As It Lays, directed by Frank Perry.
When you were writing the book, Play It As It Lays, did you ever see it as a movie? Were you surprised that it would be made into a movie?
No, I wasn't surprised that it would be made into a movie. I wish it had been made into a better movie.
It was just different, you know, it was different. The characters were different. The point was different. Everything was different, even though I wrote the screenplay.
We work in films in an odd way in that one of us writes the first draft and the other functions really kind of a super editor and writes the second draft. In the end, you can't really tell who has done what.
Writing scripts allows us to do other things. Writing scripts is also fun.
I suppose if they had a religious belief, it was in the Writers Guild medical insurance. They spoke about the Writers Guild medical insurance almost in reverential tones. When they discussed it, it was like an almost hushed tone, the Writers Guild medical insurance. Oh.
On the Malibu deck.
You've written fiction and you have written truth. Why do you write films?
I like it. It's fun. It's not like writing.
It pays good money,
it's
too.
It's like making notes for a director. It's an entirely other form of of something to do. it's
It also helps finance what you'd really like to do.
Yeah.
Which is to write.
There's no doubt about books. That. Yeah.
This book, Book of Common Prayer, is a very complicated book with a lot of layers, and yet it all flows to a common point. When you write a book like that, you keep notes over a period of time and then begin to see the story unfold in your mind.
It unfolds as you write it. I mean, that's something I never believed before I wrote a book, but it does.
The Bookshelf, Joan Didion, A Book of Common Prayer.
As you know, Joan's a complete perfectionist.
Shelley Wanger.
If she's thinking about something and feels she's stuck, she'll put it in the freezer.
Joan's editor.
Do you know that?
That's not a metaphor?
No, in the freezer.
She would put the book?
The manuscript in the freezer, you know, in a bag, and then go back to it.
The morning the FBI men came to the house on California Street, Charlotte did not understand why. She had read newspaper accounts of the events they recited. She listened attentively to everything they said. But she could make no connection between the pitiless revolutionists they described and her daughter, Marin, who at 7 had stood on a chair to make her own breakfast and wept helplessly when asked to clean her closet. Sweet Marin, or so the two FBI men tried to tell Charlotte.
Footage of Patty Hearst, Quintana and John.
I realized some years after Book of Common Prayer was finished, I realized that it was about my anticipating. Quintana was growing up. I was anticipating separation.
Illusion.
Yeah, and so I was actually working through that separation ahead of time.
Joan reads to Quintana.
So novels are also about things you're afraid you can't deal with.
An interview.
I realized that Play It As It Lays had been about mothers and daughters too on a certain level. And this Common Prayer is about a mother and a daughter and the separation between them. In that sense that a novel is a cautionary tale. If you tell the story and work it out all right, then it won't happen to you.
Older Quintana and Joan.
After the White Album, were you interested in moving away from the personal and into the larger
world?
I
was bored with it. So I wanted to move into stuff that was actually beginning to interest me more.
An article, Mrs. Reagan's White House.
It was a hard transition to make until I found the New York Review.
I asked her, I said, how did you start writing these pieces about politics and Salvador and Miami and so on? And because you always talked about how insecure you were, she said, Bob Silvers. That was her answer, was that he gave her the confidence to not even question her doing it.
Robert Silvers.
I remember reading some of her things, I believe in Life magazine, where she was a kind of special correspondent. And I thought, what a fresh voice.
But she hadn't written about domestic politics or from war zones before. How did you know she could do that?
Well, I just from talking to her and reading her work, I saw that she was immensely knowledgeable, perceptive, sharp observer. And I wanted to know, as a matter of my own curiosity, as an editor and as a friend, what she thought.
An interview.
Have you ever visited a morgue? I remember spending some time once in the Los Angeles County Morgue. Immediately, the minute you walk in, you make an accommodation so that if a body suddenly presents itself to you or touches you or something, you're not going to, or if you have to watch an autopsy, you're not going to get sick. And I think that to some extent that's what's happened in El Salvador. It's quite a brutalizing experience.
Vintage film of young men with a variety of guns.
There was this awful civil war in Salvador. The Americans were supporting a very, very brutal, terrible government. We talked about it, and the idea was that she would go there. She wanted to go there. She wanted to get in on that.
You'd pick up the paper in the morning, and
these horror stories would be there, and you kind of had to get to the bottom of them.
Was it dangerous?
What, El Salvador? It was the most dangerous place I ever hoped to be. I mean, it was terrifying.
Older Joan turns a newspaper page.
I had never covered American politics. It simply was outside my whole interest range.
The U.S. Capitol building.
It seemed to exist only to maintain itself. I mean, it didn't seem to have any relationship with the people who hung around gas stations. It didn't seem to connect with the rest of the country.
George Bush and Ronald Reagan at the Republican convention.
They tend to speak a language common in Washington, but not specifically shared by the rest of us. They talk about programs and policy and how to implement them, or about trade-offs and constituencies and positioning the candidate and distancing the candidate, about the story and how it will play.
Michael Dukakis in a tank.
They speak of a candidate's performance, by which they usually mean his skill at circumventing questions. Not as citizens, but as professional insiders, attuned to signals pitched beyond the range of normal hearing.
Dick Cheney.
Her piece on Cheney is an enormously foreseeing of the whole course of Bush politics and the Iraq War. She undertook to write about the Bush administration, the Bush War, and above all, Cheney, who she saw as a decisive and bullying and really quite brilliantly evil figure.
Richard B. Cheney reached public life with every reason to believe that he would continue to both court failure and overcome it. Take the lemons he seemed determined to pick for himself and make the lemonade, then spill it, then let somebody else clean it up.
An officer hands a folded flag to a weeping woman. Fade to black. On TV.
Wilding. New York City police say that's new teenage slang for rampaging and wolf packs, attacking people just for the fun of it.
A woman jogging in New York Central Park last Wednesday night, raped and nearly beaten to death. She is a white Wall Street investment banker. Police said the youths were joking about the crime in their jail cell.
What drew you to the Central Park jogger case?
Oh, it was just a natural story for me. Everything about that story was a lie.
She was deeply suspicious about how everyone was leaping into this double image of evil and good.
To understand is to forget.
Mayor Ed Koch.
I don't want to understand what motivates someone to engage in this kind of horror.
Calling us animals is not going to get problems solved, and this is exactly what we want to do.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it.
A headline, Trump wants thugs to fry.
One vision shared by those who had seized upon the attack on the jogger as an exact representation of what was wrong with the city was of a city systematically ruined, violated, raped by its underclass. The opposing vision shared by those who had seized upon the arrest of the defendants is an exact representation of their own victimization was of a city in which the powerless had been systematically ruined, violated, raped by the powerful. I was just this kid living in Flatbush, reading these very elegant words. When you're on that side of being described based on your skin color, you read very cynically. And so I read reports in the New York Post, the Daily News, New York Times, very cynically, and it was almost as if I was waiting for Joan to write the piece that I needed to read, because it was something that any reasonable person, once they had stripped that, as she would say, the narrative of its rhetoric, the story was of old grievances, right? Old political grievances in the city.
In a garden, lavender flowers, yellow daisies, pale orange flowers.
I myself have always found that if I examine something, it's less scary. We always had this theory that if you kept the snake in your eye line, the snake wasn't going to bite you. That's kind of the way I feel about confronting pain. I want to know where it is.
On TV.
The doctor told you, John, the ticker's bad?
The ticker is bad, and that I was a candidate for a cardiovascular catastrophe. And so that tends to focus and concentrate the mind very well. So I began to think about who I was and how I got to this point in my life and how it affected my life as a writer.
New York Central Park.
What made you move to New York?
John wanted to move. He was restless. He felt as if he was stale. His plan was to spend more time in New York.
Did you have a little resentment?
Actually, we never had any of those feelings. People found it really hard to believe, but neither John nor I was ever jealous of the other's work.
But I was happy to see him back in New York. His exercise was walking in Central Park in the mornings. Sometimes he picked up not only the gossip from the dinner party the night before, but the gossip from whoever he ran into in Central Park.
John would roll his calls every morning with fresh gossip to a core group of his friends. And if any one of us had gossip for him, he would yell, "Joan, pick up!" Even though her office was right next door. But if he did that, the gossip had to be really good.
When my wife was alive, we were couple friends, and we often went to dinner with them.
Poster-sized book jackets on a restaurant's walls. Nothing Lost by John. The Last Thing He Wanted by Joan.
Among all the married couples I knew, they were the ones who were almost always together. I always said they're the sort of married couple that finish each other's sentences, although John finishes Joan's sentences more than Joan finishes John's sentences. When you talk to them on the phone, you realize they were just sitting across from each other.
People often said that he finished sentences for me. Well, he did. He was between me and the world. He not only answered the telephone, he finished my sentences. He was the baffle between me and the world at large. You know how children are. They always feel left out. Once we talked about what kind of mother I had been, and she, to my surprise, said, "You were okay, but you were a little remote." I didn't think this at the time. I didn't see how it was possible because her father and I so clearly needed her. Which is kind of the way we tend to deal with our children. Later we realized that maybe we haven't been listening to them at all. We've been listening to the very edge of what they say without letting it sink in.
A wedding photo of Quintana and Jerry Michael.
And Q got married.
Mm-hmm.
How soon after they met did they get married?
Quite soon.
I just wondered if you were concerned about her.
Well, we were concerned about her, but not so much that she was getting married. That seemed like at that moment, it seemed like a good thing for her to do.
What more were you concerned about?
Well, I was concerned because she was drinking too much. That was the first concern.
Susan Traylor, Quintana's best friend.
She called me and said, you know, I have a new boyfriend. And I said, wow, well, that's fantastic. And she said, oh, my God, he's just amazing, and I'm so happy. And I said, well, where did you meet him? She said, well, you're not going to like it. And I said, well, what? She said, well, he works at a bar down that I go to sometimes. My parents love him, my dad. They're really happy for me. And she said, Susan, if you take this away from me, this is the greatest thing that has ever happened to me. I don't even think I can talk to you if you can't be happy for me.
Photos, Quintana the bride with her bouquet of flowers and long veil. Joan in her sunglasses next to the bride. Attendants and flower girls all wearing floral leis. John escorting the bride down the aisle. Lynn Nesbitt, John and Joan's literary agent.
Oh, they were so pleased and happy, and Quintana looked so happy. Everything, you know, seemed to be going so well. And then we all, trooped over to the parish part of the house for a little wedding reception.
John, Quintana, and Joan. John points by a table with the cake.
We wish them happiness. We wish them health. We wish them love and luck and beautiful children.
Quintana in a car.
On that wedding day, July 26, 2003, we could see no reason to think that such ordinary blessings would not come their way. Do notice, we still counted happiness and health and love and luck and beautiful children as ordinary blessings.
December 24th, 2003.
Quintana had been too sick on Christmas Eve to come to dinner. In the morning, she called and said she could hardly breathe. She had gone to the emergency room the night before, but it was back again. By the time she got to the hospital, she was in need of dramatic care. She was very near death then.
Quintana had been taken in with something that seemed not that serious, like the flu or something like that, but it had quickly developed into something else, and she was in the ICU, and she had a tube down her throat and for breathing, so when, and John talked about all that and talked about it in detail, but his voice just sounded different from any time I'd ever heard it.
John's voice just started to break, and I'd never heard him like that.
He was sobbing and saying, you know, Quintana is so sick, I just don't know, I'm just so worried.
A snowy New York street.
We sat down. My attention was on mixing the salad. John was talking, then he wasn't. His left hand was raised and he was slumped motionless. I remember saying, don't do that. When he did not respond, my first thought was that he had started to eat and choked. I remember trying to lift him far enough from the back of the chair to give him the Heimlich. I remember the sense of his weight as he fell forward, first against the table, then to the floor.
That night, I got a call saying, listen, I just spoke to Nick Dunn. I have something terrible to tell you. And I said, oh, my God, Quintana died. And she paused and she said, no, not Quintana, but John.
On the night that he died, I came back here. There was not much. There was not much else to do. You know, I called her father. That was the first thing I did. And I had that obligatory conversation. And then that was it.
Tony Dunn, nephew.
After John died, you know, it was like a, it wasn't like an Irish wake. It was like a Shiva. There were people at the house all the time until you told them to leave.
I was up there a lot for the next couple of weeks. Her daughter was still in intensive care and John was gone. And remember, we were all concerned she wouldn't eat, and I found that she would eat congee. So I would go to Chinatown and get congee, which is sort of a rice porridge. And finally, she said, Calvin, I think we've had enough congee.
Tony with a dark-haired woman.
By that time, I had gotten married to Rosemary. We lived around the corner. More often than not, Rosemary would come over. But this particular night, which I think was fairly early in the going, we went into John's office, and Joan opened one of the closets. She was just standing there thinking for a while. And I'm looking at all this stuff, assuming that we're both thinking the same thing, that you have to get rid of these clothes eventually. She said, but what if he comes back? And all I remember is that at that moment, it didn't seem far-fetched to me at all. In fact, it seemed plausible.
There couldn't be a funeral for John until Quintana was well enough to go to it. For the funeral, she was not, you know, she didn't seem too strong,
yeah.
You know, then. And, you know, she made a plan to go to Los Angeles the next day.
I hate to say, but I encouraged her to go to Los Angeles because I thought it would be good for her. I mean, I was totally wrong. On the other hand, it could have been a pretty idea, a day in Malibu, right? But it wasn't.
That's what she wanted, to go back to Malibu where you guys...
Yeah.
Where she was raised. Yeah, of course.
She came off the plane and fell and hit her head and, you know, she thought she was okay. And as those kind of brain injuries, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly she wasn't okay.
The fall at the airport sent Quintana into a coma. 2 years of rehabilitation followed, but at the end, she lost her will to fight back, and her health rapidly declined. That summer, she just finally let go.
A marble marker, John Gregory Dunn and Quintana Rue Dunn Michael, fade to black. The bookshelf, the year of magical thinking, Joan at her desk.
Grief turns out to be a place none of us know until we reach it.
A photo and a child's note and drawings. A photo of John kissing Joan.
We know that someone close to us could die. We might expect to feel shock. We do not expect this shock to be obliterative, dislocating to both body and mind.
Joan plucks herbs and sets them on a sandwich.
We might expect to be prostrate, inconsolable, crazy with loss. We do not expect to be literally crazy, cool customers who believe their husband is about to return and need his shoes. Nor can we know the unending absence that follows, the void. The relentless succession of moments during which we will confront the experience of meaninglessness itself.
Very thin Joan removes her glasses.
The reason I had to write it down was nobody had ever told me what it was like. It was a coping mechanism, it turned out, but I didn't plan it that way.
The manuscript kind of just showed up. I knew she was working on something, but she doesn't really talk about what she's working on. I took it home, and, well, you can imagine, it was an incredible thing and unexpected. And I think she felt she had to do this. She had to kind of get it down to understand it as what, but it was so amazing, the two events happening, you know, John and then Quintana. And of course, Quintana is not in the book, even though she had died that August, and I got the book in October.
It's the first book about grief, not by a believer. Joan Didion, goodness knows, believes in human achievement. For someone with that perspective to write about coming up against this great big wall of loss, void, the person she loved most in the world disappearing, speaks to a whole section of people who have had nothing to read at all on that subject.
Tony with Rosemary.
Who knows what to do or how to do it? You could be grieving your wife who died a month ago.
Rosemary Breslin Dunn, 1957-2004.
Everybody else has moved on. And everything is normal. A matter of months has gone by. And I guess you're supposed to be just normal.
The Angel of the Waters on the Bethesda Fountain.
Again, she wasn't writing through the haze of romanticism. She was writing through the deeply felt poignancy of someone who could report on grief.
A photo of John.
It's the hardest thing to write about. She did it as a reporter.
A light breeze ruffles Joan's straight, light brown hair.
She did it as, quote-unquote, the Joan Didion character of the novels in a true story about grief.
An interview.
Well, I think the hardest thing was finishing it, because for as long as I was writing it, I was in touch with him in some way, you know?
Yeah. And when you finish the book?
She throws up a hand. Waves roll at Malibu.
We all know that if we are to live ourselves, there comes a time when we must relinquish our dead. Let them go, keep them dead. Let go of them in the water.
Joan with small Quintana.
Let them become the photograph on the table. Knowing this does not make it any easier to let go of them in the water. I did not want the year after either of them died to end. I knew that as the second year began and the days passed, certain things would happen. My image of them at the moment of death would become something that happened in another year. My sense of John and Quintana themselves, John and Quintana alive, would become more remote, softened, transmuted into whatever best served my life without them. In fact, this is already happening.
Floral leis are tossed in the water.
For once in your life, just let it go.
The leis drift away. Fade to black. Joan walks down the hall of her apartment.
Hey.
Griffin enters.
Look how much soup you have. Who makes all the soup for you?
What soup?
All this, not soup.
No, that's ice cream.
Griffin feels the need to report that he has been getting calls from concerned friends. The focus of their concern is my health, specifically my weight. I point out that I have weighed the same amount since the early 1970s. Griffin says that he recognizes this. He is only reporting what those concerned friends have mentioned to him.
I had been thinking that maybe it was time to do something totally new, and it might be interesting to do a play. So I had some conversations with David Hare.
When we came to make a play, faced with, you know, two problems. One, that she had never written a play before. But secondly, we were faced with the very real problem that Quintana, her daughter, had died since the book was written. And whereas the book was about grief for her husband, since then, her daughter had died. And so I was faced with the unhappy task of saying to Joan that she would have to open up about material which is not in the book, but which would be in the play, and about which I think at the time she had no intention of writing. But I think one of the wonderful things about working with Joan is that she doesn't ever let any discomfort she is feeling show. And so she never said to me, this is fantastically painful. She just regarded it as a job to be done, and it had to be done. And I think it was done at immense personal cost and expense. At that point, she was down to £75. And I said, if I do this play, I'm going to put some flesh on her bones. That's what we're going to achieve. We're going to plump her up by doing this play. We're going to make her happy, and by making her happy, we're never going to make her fat, but we're not going to keep her at £75. We're going to get... And we did. In other words, I fed her. And I would... If I was working with her, we'd have sandwiches, and I'd say, I'm not going to eat my sandwich until you eat yours, Joan. You are going to eat that sandwich. We just fed her, and finally the stage manager formalized it to a point where she put a table up in the wings of the theatre, and she put a red check tablecloth, and she put a sign saying Café Didion in the wings of the theatre. And so between shows or before the show, she'd come in, and we'd give her croissants and jam or soup. By the time the run was over, she was in pretty good shape. We were very pleased with ourselves. And I said, I don't care whether this play is a service to art. It is a service to humanity. We've got Joan blooming again. And I think the play gave her a frame to her life at a very, very, very difficult time.
On stage, David, Vanessa Redgrave, and Joan.
The larger thing I came to understand was the value of that communal experience. The audience is in the collaboration, too. Yeah. And we all are in it together, which is very like life itself, right?
A performance. Vanessa Redgrave.
This happened on December 30, 2003. That may seem a while ago, but it won't when it happens to you. And it will happen to you. The details will be different, but it will happen to you. That's what I'm here to tell you.
Fade to black.
It was lovely.
Vanessa and Joan.
For me to see the pictures of you and John getting ready. Can you see all right there, or shall I tilt it up a little bit? Because I don't think you can see otherwise, can you?
I can see. Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Well, she has dark glasses on anyway.
There, you look very glamorous. I'm not saying you don't, haven't often, if not always, looked extremely glamorous. But that one looks particularly sort of dark glasses glamorous.
Oh, look here.
And here's the lovely, lovely girls.
Wedding photos.
In March 2009, Tash died.
Photos of Natasha Richardson, Vanessa's daughter.
I got a different understanding how things change, but not only change in a way that you certainly hadn't expected, but also change our perceptions. That's what the Year of Magical Thinking was about.
This one is John.
There's John,
standing
yes.
Next to Tasha.
Vanessa points to Joan in a picture.
I'm so glad you brought these up.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad too. It changed my perceptions in a specific, amongst other ways, that I understood something I hadn't before, which was that you don't get all gloomy doomy.
Joan nods.
Yes.
The bookshelf, Blue Nights. Gray skies hang over New York City.
This book is called Blue Nights because at the time I began it, I found my mind turning increasingly to illness, to the end of promise, the dwindling of the days, the inevitability of the fading, the dying of the brightness. Blue nights are the opposite of the dying of the brightness, but they are also its warning.
Writing Blue Nights was quite a different experience, I wanted to, for you, creatively.
It was hard, actually. I thought, in the middle of it, I thought, I don't have to finish this. And I almost abandoned it then. But I went on.
Was that because it was about Quintana?
Because it was about Quintana.
Quintana by a fountain.
When she wrote Blue Nights, then when I read it, I sent her a message, you know. And she just said, well, I only wrote it for you. She said, I had no other reason to write it except to write it for you. And I was very, very upset by this. And she said, I knew you'd be the only person who'd understand this book. And I said, well, I won't be the only person who'll understand this book. Lots of people understand it. But I was incredibly moved that she, Blue Nights was her way of completing the process we'd been through together.
I just think she wanted to think about bringing up Quintana and what had happened. And I, you know, with Joan, I think she always writes to find out what she thinks and what she feels. And so I think that's what Blue Nights was partly about. And maybe it's a kind of release, too. The idea that you get it down and then it's, I don't think, not that she wants to forget it, but it just clarifies it in some way.
Joan in the garden.
I couldn't in any way confront the death of my daughter for a long time. She was much more troubled than I ever recognized or admitted, because she was, at the same time that she was very troubled, she was infinitely amusing and charming. And that's naturally what I tended to focus on.
Video and photos of Quintana.
Most of us go through life trying to focus on what works for us. And her amusing side definitely worked for me.
Quintana by a Christmas tree.
When I was little, the Donner Party was taught to children in California. The interesting part of the story is the failure to plan for misfortune, to plan to protect one another, to protect themselves.
Joan and Quintana. In a cathedral.
She was adopted. She had been given to me to take care of, and I had failed to do that, so there was a huge guilt.
A row of lit candles.
One of the things that worries us about dying always is that we're afraid we're leaving people behind and they won't be able to take care of themselves. We have to take care of them. But in fact, you see, I'm not leaving anybody behind.
The marble marker.
I know that I can no longer reach her. I know that should I try to reach her, she will fade from my touch. Vanish. Pass into nothingness. Fade as the blue nights fade. Go as the brightness goes. Go back into the blue. I myself placed her ashes in the wall. I know what it is I am now experiencing. I know what the frailty is. I know what the fear is. The fear is not for what is lost. What is lost is already in the wall. The fear is for what is still to be lost. You may see nothing still to be lost. Yet there is no day in her life on which I do not see her.
Traffic passes behind Joan. A breeze brushes her hair. Fade to black. Joan's hand is on Griffin's arm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the White House. Thank you for joining us to celebrate Joan Didion, who rightly has earned distinction as one of the most celebrated American writers of her generation. I'm surprised she hadn't already gotten this award.
A military officer in whites escorts Joan to the president. He leans down and shakes her hand.
For her mastery of style in writing, exploring the culture around us and exposing the depths of sorrow, Miss Didion has produced works of startling honesty and fierce intellect, rendered personal stories universal, and illuminated the seemingly peripheral details that are central to our lives.
President Obama places the red-ribboned medal around Joan's neck and kisses her. The officer returns to her. Michelle Obama beams. In Joan's apartment, windows overlook a church.
See enough and write it down, I tell myself. And then some morning when the world seems drained of wonder, some day when I'm only going through the motions of doing what I am supposed to do, which is write.
The bookshelf with the journal.
On that bankrupt morning, I will simply open my notebook and there it will all be, a forgotten account with accumulated interest. Paid passage back to the world out there.
Young Joan in braids. John and Joan with the ocean beyond. Quintana, John, and Joan on the deck in Malibu, in the apartment.
It all comes back. Remember what it is to be me. That is always the point.
She walks down the hall. Fade to black. Words appear, reading from the works of Joan Didion. 1. Slouching Toward Bethlehem. 2. On Keeping a Notebook. 3. Goodbye to All That. 4. On Self-Respect. 5. John Wayne, A Love Song. 6. Play It As It Lays. 7. A Book of Common Prayer. 8. The White Album. 9. In the Islands. 10. Salvador. 11. Inside Baseball. 12. Sentimental Journeys. 13. Where I Was From. 14. Cheney, The Fatal Touch. 15. The Year of Magical Thinking. 16. Blue Nights. Credits appear. Directed by Griffin Dunn. Produced by Mary Racine. Annabelle Dunn. Produced by Griffin Dunn. Executive Producer, Ben Kottner. Jason Spingham-Koff. Lisa Nishimura. Edited by Ann Collins. Cinematography by Tom Hurwitz, ASC. Reed Moreno, ASC. William Rexner. Readings by Hilton Owls. David Hare. Phyllis Riffild. Amy Robinson. Shelley Wanger. Music by Nathan Halpern. Associate Producer, Erica Rose. Archival Producer, Michelle Sullivan. Archival Researchers, Jillian Bergman. Leah Giussino. Consulting Producer, Susan Traylor. Producer, Suzanne Rostock. Credits continue. This film could not have been made without the support of our extraordinary Kickstarter donors. Thank you for being part of this journey with us. Copyright 2017, Netflix Studios, LLC, and Netflix Global, LLC. All rights reserved. Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix.